We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Welcome back to Focus 580, our morning talk show here on WILL AM 580. This is Carol Spindell. I'm sitting in today for David Inge. Before we get started, we'd like to thank John Bonacorsi of Brown University for helping us with the ISDN line today. Thank you. We're going to talk today about corruption, a topic that weighs heavily on our minds here in the state of Illinois, and we're going to try to understand corruption from an anthropological perspective. To help us with that, our guest today is Professor Dan Smith. He's an anthropologist and an associate professor of anthropology at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. He has worked for many years in Nigeria, among other places, and has written a book called A Culture of Corruption, Everyday Deception and Popular Discontent in Nigeria. A Culture of Corruption was published by Princeton University Press in 2000 and won the 2008 Margaret Mead Award. Professor Smith, thanks for joining us today, and welcome to Focus 580.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Professor Smith is joining us by phone today from Providence. So, and we will be taking phone calls as we talk. Our numbers here at Focus 580 are 217-333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Well, even here in central Illinois, in our interconnected international world, most of us have been touched by Nigerian corruption because we have received scam emails asking us to send money so that the email writers can share a large sum of money with us that they supposedly have access to. Now, you went around to internet cafes in Nigeria and interviewed writers of these scam emails. Who did they turn out to be?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think the perception perhaps here is that it's a few well-placed people who have access to government resources and so on in Nigeria that they can mobilize to make these scams happen. But the reality is that the people sending most of these scam letters are young people, mostly in their 20s, people who've finished high school, people who are trying to get into university. It's by and large a young population of people who have aspirations. And they've found their way into these internet cafes, and they've learned about this business of sending email scam letters. And there are literally thousands of these young men and women in internet cafes across Nigeria sending out these email scam letters.
And these young letter writers that you interviewed, that you found in the cafes, I assume it took some time to gain their trust and so on, had they made much money from the dupes who received the emails and sent the money?
No. I mean, the vast majority of these thousands of young people who are spending hours at a time in the internet cafe sending these messages trying to get your money are never getting anything from this practice. I mean, what I found out was that there are some loose aspects of organization to all this. So a young person who's sending a scam letter will, hope for a response from the many hundreds of people that they might send the message to. And then if they get a response, they'll probably try to email you back and convince you to talk to them on the phone, or if they're lucky, have you provide them your bank account number and, maybe even forward them some money as an advance against the supposed big payoff. But the vast majority of people who are sending the scams don't get responses. They don't get any money. They don't get anybody's bank account. And in some ways, it's akin to playing the lottery in the United States. I mean, the vast majority of people who are doing it don't win.
Mm. Now, you pointed out that these letters have storylines that refer to current events. And they also often refer to the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation. So it seems like that you point out that this shows us that the people who write these letter writers are aware of where the corruption and fraud originates from in their country, in a way, the corruption central. Is that true, that oil and the petroleum corporation, the government, that is that the reality? Are people right that this is the heart of Nigerian corruption in a way?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the most interesting things about doing the study was learning to think about what's going on with these scam letter writers from a different kind of perspective. I mean, I think that the majority of Americans who receive the scam letters read them and think, who in the world would fall for such a preposterous scheme? And there's a couple things to say about that. One, it's actually remarkable that there are a lot of Americans who do fall for these schemes. Mm. There are people who respond who think that this might be a real chance to get some quick money. And indeed, when I talk to the scam letter writers and ask them whether they were sympathetic to the people who they might dupe and would feel sorry for them, some of them said yes, they were, and they really felt bad about what they were doing. But others mm-hmm. said, look, if somebody's going to fall for this, you know, they have plenty of money and they're greedy, and you know, so they have only themselves to blame. But what was really interesting about you know, about learning the connections between the scam letter writers, the scam letters themselves, and the real processes of corruption in Nigeria, was that I came to have a very different view of what these seemingly preposterous letters represented. So while we tend to see them as complete fabrications that must be fantastic, fantastic inventions of the imagination that couldn't have any basis in reality, in fact, young people who are writing these letters, I came to conclude, were astute observers of the actual mechanisms of corruption that exist in their society. And from my point of view, one of the most important things to point out about those mechanisms of corruption is that so many of the ways in which actual corruption functions in Nigeria are no more fantastic than, and in some ways are even more fantastic than what appear in these letters. And what is more, much of that corruption takes place at the nexus between the Nigerian state and the wider world, including America. So mm-hmm. The fact that so many of the letters focus on the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, or that they focus on international development organizations, or on the supposedly huge amounts of money that foreign expatriates working in Nigeria have accumulated in a bank account, or that the widow of a former dictator has access to because her husband stole so much money. All of those things are reflections of realities of corruption in Nigeria. And what's interesting to me is that they reveal, you know, a degree of awareness that these young people have about the real mechanisms of corruption in their society.
Yeah, that is really interesting. You talk about the very sophisticated ways in which Nigerians talk about corruption. Western diplomats and development experts often cite corruption as the reason why their projects go awry in sub-Saharan Africa. And they often use corruption and bad governance as a justification for why they won't invest in sub-Saharan Africa. And I just wanted to point out for listeners who haven't read this book that, in contrast, you write about Nigerian culture with an obvious affection. You live there for years. You have friends and, even more importantly, family there. In your case, the anthropological idea of participant observation is weighted toward participation, it seems. Has this insider status changed how you do your anthropological and ethnographic work?
And no question about it. I mean, certainly I didn't mean to participate in corruption, and yet, you know, when one lives one's everyday life in Nigeria, it's almost impossible not to be confronted by the ways in which Nigerians in their everyday lives must confront the corruption that permeates the state just in order to achieve their most mundane kinds of aspirations. So, you know, when I tried to get a driver's license in Nigeria so that I could drive myself around, I found myself in offices where you know, where it's expected that I would pay some kind of bribe in order to get the license. When I wanted to extend my visa and I would go to the immigration service, usually people would ask in some kind of way for me to, you know, put something on top of the fee that was expected of me. When you're driving around the country, you get stopped at police checkpoints and you're asked to show your papers and your documents and so on, and they're always looking for some little thing that might be wrong so that they can extort things from you. But one of the things I learned through all that was that there's this constant jockeying that people are doing when they're facing corruption in the state, and that is that they're trying to take the people who are representing the state are trying to take the official rules and use it as a way to extort money from people. But people who are in interaction with the state are trying to draw on idioms of kinship and more personalized kinds of relationships to get people who work in the state to do things without requiring the bribe, and sometimes even without requiring to pay the official fee. And so there's this constant dynamic between the ways in which people's rootedness in a more personalistic way of getting along with others both facilitates corruption and is also a strategy to try to get around the most egregious forms of corruption. One of the things I was trying – sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that one of the things I was trying to do in the book, and one of the the big motives for writing the book, was that there's this seeming paradox or contradiction between with regard to how ordinary citizens in Nigeria experience corruption. On the one hand, everybody in Nigeria is vitally aware of the prevalence and in many ways the corrosive nature of corruption in their society, and they complain about it constantly. On the second hand, they are clearly victims, right? So they're complaining mm-hmm. about corruption in their society. They're victims of corruption. And yet in all these insidious ways, they're participants in making corruption continue because people feel like, the system is bad, but if they don't participate in it, they're not going to be able to get what they need in order to just accomplish the most mundane of everyday tasks, including things like getting access to healthcare at a hospital or, getting their kid admitted into high school or college or something like that.
Yeah, you tell the story and you have a photograph of the book of a house which has painted on it a warning, which I guess is very common in Nigeria. This house is not for sale. Just to make sure that in case someone is being scammed and someone is trying to sell my house, for example, someone who comes to look at it will know that, no, it's not for sale. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that, the sort of global reputation that Nigeria has for corruption comes, I think primarily through these widely broadcast email messages trying to get people to give money up front for some supposed big payoff. And to some extent also, through Nigeria's reputation as a place that where there's these sort of big criminal gangs that organize fraud and so on. But working in Nigeria, one realizes that by far the biggest victims of Nigerian fraud and corruption are Nigerians themselves. And so I was struck when I first started working there almost 20 years ago that all these houses had painted or written or stenciled on the outside of their doors, "This house is not for sale," right? In our society, when you see a sign in front of a house, it says, "This house is for sale." And I was like, why would someone advertise that their house is not for sale? And of course, people explained to me that they were worried that their house would get caught up in some kind of fraudulent deal because people had experiences of fraudsters posing as real estate agents and pretending that a house was for sale and then selling it out from under them. And of course, the real fear among people who have that happen is that, because political power is such an important determinant of who can make the state act on their behalf, some people fear that their house might be sold fraudulently out from under them and then they might actually lose it to a powerful buyer who had better connections.
Right, right. It's a constant – you refer to it as a preoccupation. And obviously, if you're not preoccupied, you're going to find yourself homeless or in some big trouble. You've got to be preoccupied in order to constantly be battling against this. Now, in a lot of cases, you refer to in the book 419, fraud or corruption is 419. Could you explain what that means and why we hear it talked about as 419?
Sure. So interestingly, when Nigeria was a British colony from the early part of the 20th century up until 1960 when Nigeria got independence, and in the Nigerian Penal Code, which is a legacy of the British colonial administration, the number in the Penal Code for advance fee fraud, which is the technical term for this enterprise of trying to get people to pay you some amount of money up front in order to get a bigger payoff. The technical term for that is advance fee fraud. And the number in the Nigerian Penal Code for advance fee fraud is 419. And so it became a sort of popular way of describing this practice of advance fee fraud. But it's become a much larger sort of signifier or metaphor in Nigerian society. So when people talk about 419 now, They're sometimes talking about these email scams, but they're often talking about other forms of deception and duplicity, which they think characterize everyday life. Interestingly, I learned recently, I had an email from a journalist in India who's writing about corruption there. And she tells me that the number in the Indian penal code, again, a legacy of the British colonial era, for this same practice is 420. And that in India, people talk about similar kinds of practices and they call it 420.
Funny that it's so close, just one more.
Yeah.
And it sounds like from what you're saying that it's just become such a common expression. A woman, for example, instead of saying, oh, you know, I had this boyfriend and he did me wrong, you know, might say he 419'd me.
Right. Right. What they often say is he played me 419.
He played me 419.
Played me 419. So, you know, I mean, one of the things that I really tried to get across in the book was the degree to which ordinary Nigerians themselves are really upset about corruption. And, and yet they participate in it. And so I was posed with the challenge of how do you make sense of the fact that people are angry about corruption and they see certain forms of corruption as immoral. They certainly – Nigerians themselves certainly see their society as a society in crisis. And I found 419, that the concept, the sort of local concept of 419, to be a very revealing way of distinguishing forms of corruption that Nigerians themselves found to be morally problematic and socially intolerable, and forms of corruption that they find more acceptable. So, in Nigerian society, if you're trying to help people who are from your family, if you're trying to help people who are from your village of origin, if you're trying to help a friend, there's actually a strong kind of moral pressure to do that in ways that, you know, we might call corruption or we might call nepotism. And many Nigerians wouldn't condemn that form of behavior because they live in a world where you cannot rely on the state to be a neutral arbiter of what's fair and what isn't. And so people continue to rely on ties of kinship and, you know, what in anthropology and the social sciences we call patron-clientism, ties between people who have more resources and power and people who have less. But these ties are ties that have a moral and an emotional bond to them. And so people end up relying on those kinds of ties to get access to social resources. And when people do that and the beneficiaries are their own family, their own community members, their own friends, and so on, people tend not to see that behavior as corrupt. Mm-hmm. But what's happened over time in Nigeria is that more and more of the resources that people want access to are controlled by the state, and the state runs ostensibly by the kinds of bureaucratic rules of accountability that characterize states everywhere, including in our society. And what's happened is that political elites have tried to use the facades of the state and the rules of the game in order to facilitate brands of corruption that aren't benefiting anybody's family and aren't benefiting anybody's village of origin and friends and so on. And it's those mechanisms of corruption that Nigerians tend to label as 419. And what they worry is that this practice of not taking care of your obligations to your people is something that's pervading society more widely, and hence the popularity of this idiomatic expression of 419 to characterize forms of deception and duplicity that everybody finds problematic.
I want to just tell our listeners, reintroduce our guest at the moment. Our guest today is Professor Dan Smith, an anthropology from Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. He's joining us by phone. And we are talking about his book, A Culture of Corruption, Everyday Deception and Popular Discontent in Nigeria. And we're trying to get a sense of how a culture of corruption gets started, is maintained, who participates, who suffers, and trying to understand that from an anthropological perspective. You're welcome to join our conversation by calling 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And this is Carol Spindell, and I'm sitting in today for David Inge. So thanks for listening. There's small-scale 419, and there's large-scale 419. And the large-scale 419 seems to be perpetrated by people who already have a lot of power and wealth. And it sounds like, from your book, rarely gets prosecuted. People are very aware of it, but it goes kind of unchecked. And I also was struck by another phrase that Nigerians use in this whole discussion, very evocative phrase, I thought, that they have for the government wealth obtained through oil revenues, the national cake. Because, I mean, some countries might be so poor in sub-Saharan Africa that they really wouldn't have a national cake. Cake is kind of a rich thing. But at the same time, Nigeria does. And cake gets eaten up. It gets stale. You have to eat it. The implication seems to be that if I don't reach out and get my slice of that sweet national oil cake, because Nigeria is a rich country filled with poor people, you know, someone else will eat my slice, so I just might as well.
Absolutely. People talk about the national cake all the time, and getting one's share of the national cake. And there's certainly a perception that if you leave all that oil revenue to be divvied up by the people who control the state, and you don't try to get your share, you're going to be left behind. Nigeria is an incredibly rich country. It exports something like 2 million barrels of oil a day. It's the 8th largest oil exporter in the world. It's the 5th largest exporter to the United States. And it's a particularly important exporter to the United States because the kind of oil that Nigeria exports is the kind that's most easily refined into the gasoline that's so vital for our economy. And so we have a tremendous national interest in the stability of Nigeria. But I think one of the unfortunate consequences of our national interest in the oil wealth in Nigeria is that to some extent, our government has been willing to look the other way as Nigeria has had a series of military governments, as the civilian governments that have been in power since Nigeria made a transition back to democratically elected governments in 1999, as civilian governments haven't done a particularly good job of cleaning up corruption or dealing with the vast inequalities that exist in society. We've been relatively willing – America has been relatively willing to overlook those kinds of problems in Nigeria because our primary national interest is to keep the oil flowing.
And you cite the 7 kinds of corruption that you see in Nigeria today. I was just going to go through them. I mean, when we talk about he played me 419, that's a personal thing, but corruption is misuse by a public official for personal gain. I think you would define it as, and I think most of us would define it that way. And you talk about the commission or payment for illicit services, unwarranted payment for public services when you go to get a job done that you should get done for free or for a small fee, and you have to pay. You talked about gratuities, giving someone a tip after they do something for you, and it seems to be expected. You talked about string pulling, which I think – maybe you implied is more socially acceptable and even can be seen as a morally good thing. You talked about levies and tolls where people are on the road and they're stopped and they have to pay. And this is, you know, widely – people really complain about this. People really feel strongly that this is wrong and amoral. You talked about sidelining where people use something that belongs to the public on their own time, like a car or something like that. And misappropriation, which I guess would cover embezzlement. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
So actually taking something or funds that belong to the public, to the government. And, you know, it occurred to me reading these different things and reading your examples, we don't have in this country people that stop us on the road and extort money so that we can go down the interstate. We don't usually have to give tips except in certain service areas that are kind of strictly defined. And we don't often go to a government office and have to pay to get the person who's on a salary to do their job for us. But those other 4 that you mentioned are quite common in our society. And so that made me wonder, is corruption culturally specific or is it more of a kind of part of social interaction and culture worldwide? I mean, what do you think about that?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, one of the things that I worried about when I was planning to write this book about corruption in Nigeria was that there might be a perception both among readers in our society but also among Nigerians themselves that what I was trying to say is that there's something somehow inherently corrupt about culture in Nigeria. And that's certainly not the argument that I want to make. I think that the lens of corruption as a way to understand problems in places like Nigeria can be a very deceiving one. We can end up convincing ourselves that corruption is something that happens in other people's societies and not so much when you get a modern and bureaucratic state like our own. And of course, as people listening in Illinois know well, corruption is not something that's unique to Nigeria or unique
to
Africa.
And some of our listeners are calling in. So let's see. Let's go to line one in Charleston. And hello, line one in Charleston. Are you there?
Yes, Dr. Smith, thank you for the book. I'm also a Nigerian, as you can tell. How long did you live in Nigeria, and where did you live?
I've spent about 6 or 7 years living in Nigeria, and I live primarily in the southeast. So I lived for 3 years in Owerri, which is the capital of Imo State, and I live for I lived for a few years in a small community outside Umuahia, which is in Abia State.
That is exactly around where I come from. But my other question is, you said that it is not inherent, it's not, I don't want to use the word biological, but do you think it's just conformity, you know, people not knowing what is right from what is wrong, or people not having a choice? Because myself, I have had family members, even who are straight A students, trying to get into a university only to be told to pay some kind of fees. And then when you actually look at it, it's so frustrating because if you don't do anything about it, then that child is denied that education. So,
yes.
So I'm thinking that a lot of people in Nigeria are frustrated with, you know, what's going on, and they really don't have a choice because no government official has been convicted of corruption. No high-level government official has been convicted for corruption. So you see it everywhere. And people are just, you know, helpless. And this is what my opinion is about.
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right that there is a tremendous amount of frustration in Nigeria. I mean, one of the things that I found most characteristic of Nigerian society was the degree to which people in the society were aware of the problems in their own society and were vocal critics of it. But what is so tough about the issue of corruption is that even as people are angry and frustrated and see that in some long-term sense corruption doesn't serve their society well, as you say, people feel like they have no choice. They feel caught up in it. They feel like if they don't pay, they don't want to pay a bribe to get their child into secondary school or into university, and yet they feel like if they don't do it, they're not going to get access to the kinds of opportunities and social resources that they deserve. One of the things I try to convey in the book is that in my mind, even though the title of the book is A Culture of Corruption, in my mind, contemporary Nigeria needs to be understood as much in terms of a culture against corruption as a culture of corruption. I mean, in everyday life, people are both participating in corruption, but they're also constantly trying to navigate it and avoid it and try to prevent it from impinging on their lives. And I'm actually relatively optimistic when it comes to Nigeria, because I think that eventually and hopefully inevitably, this kind of collective self-awareness about the problems in society will lead to social change. It'll lead to a situation where leaders must become more accountable for their actions. And I think one's already seen trends in that regard. I mean, there's certainly still plenty of corruption in the state in Nigeria, but leaders can no longer avoid the issue. And even though they may not have done enough to combat it yet, now if you're a politician in Nigeria, you can't be heard to not preach against corruption. Otherwise, nobody's going to listen to you.
Okay. Thank you very much for the book.
Thank you for calling. And now we have a caller on line four calling us from Crete. Hello. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call. My question kind of goes along with the cultural comment that you made prior to taking callers, in the sense, do we find the corruption along ethnic lines? Does ethnicity play anything a role in it? Because I'm thinking about American corruption, and a lot of the political corruption that we find is really just about staying in power and benefiting individually. And I don't know if we can talk about American culture or American corruption in the lines of ethnicity. But I'm just wondering if the Nigerian ethnic groups, if corruption falls along those lines.
Well, one of the things that happens in places like Nigeria is that people organize themselves along lines of multiple kinds of affiliation. And so certainly ethnic affiliation is one kind of affiliation. And so it's true that someone who is trying to seek the favor of someone who has power will try to mobilize any connection that they have to them. But the most important ones are family connections, connections to place of origin, are connections based on friendship and association and so on. But people will try to, you know, go into an office and say, you're of the same ethnic group as me, you ought to help me. But my view is that the ethnic component actually obscures from our view the more important thing that's going on, which is a much more economic and class-based phenomenon. So what's really happening with corruption in Nigeria, and this is why ordinary people feel aggrieved by it even as they have to participate in it, what's really going on with corruption in Nigeria is that it serves to maintain elite interest. It serves to maintain class interests. And so politicians will play up this ethnic dimension of things. But if you look at what's going on at the top levels of Nigerian society, in fact, the elites of different ethnic groups are all in the same ballgame together. And even though they will make it appear to their co-ethnics in their regions that they're trying hard to benefit their own ethnic groups, in the end, they're really just trying to benefit themselves. And the ties that are more important are class ties, not ethnic ties.
If I could follow up, is there a national identity, a Nigerian national identity that would take in ideas of equality that would, in a sense, or is formulating that could defeat this type of corruption?
Well, I think a Nigerian national identity is still in the making. And, you know, I think sadly for a lot of Nigerians, you know, the global reputation of Nigeria as a corrupt country that's the home of scams and 419 and so on has become a de facto Nigerian identity that Nigerians themselves have had to combat. And so many Nigerians at home in Nigeria and abroad find themselves engaged in a project of a construction of a national identity that works against this image of Nigeria as a corrupt place. And well, on the one hand, you know, the reputation of Nigeria as corrupt is sad for many Nigerians because so many Nigerians aren't corrupt and don't want to be corrupt. On the other hand, I think it has created a certain sense of solidarity among Nigerians in the face of their global reputation. And, you know, I often get asked by you know, sort of policymakers in America and so on whether I think that Nigeria is going to fall apart. And Nigerians themselves sometimes talk about whether they're going to fall apart along ethnic or religious or regional lines or something like that. And the reality is that in Nigeria, people's lives are deeply intertwined across ethnic and religious and regional lines. And even though Nigerians themselves are constantly in a sort of collective debate about whether they have a Nigerian national identity, in my view, the fact that they're having that debate all the time is evidence that they do.
Right. Well, I appreciate the hour, and thank you for the book.
Thank you
so much for calling. We have another caller on line two, so we're going to go directly to you. Hello. Thank you for calling from Champaign County.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to bring up – I appreciate your putting it, the Illinois corruption right up front, and I think we can talk about perhaps Manhattan and, you know, where else in the world do we have $40 billion scams? So where is the culture of corruption really blooming the best? But along with that, it seems to me that I get furious when I hear people bemoaning lesser developed countries' corruption, because a lot of the corruption, it seems to me, comes from the North and the corrupting influence of corporate power. And we have, you know, a pretty much uncommented on example of our ex-Vice President Cheney. Cheney was head of Halliburton when Sonny Abacha got millions of dollars to grease a combination deal for liquid natural gas. that Halliburton actually paid $600 million to settle a long-running investigation to the SEC.
That's right.
My understanding, because Total is involved, that there's still a French case going that hasn't been settled. So it just seems to me that it's casting the mote out in your neighbor's eye instead of your own to not see that it's those poor natives or something, you know, they're just so primitive. It's a lot of this is really the corrupting, not to say that human frailty isn't ubiquitous, but the fact that we can have a vice president who's, you know, perhaps eventually going to be on the docket, and as his corporation actually admitted to bribing Sonny Abacha at the time of killings of Nigerian. Anyway, I'm starting to fulminate here. I'd just like for you to react to that. And,
sure.
I wanted to get it out.
No, I agree with much of, if not all of what you're saying. I mean, when I anticipated writing the book, for many years I kind of put it off, in part because I was afraid of an interpretation of a book about corruption in Nigeria, which would further enable us to pretend that corruption is only a problem of the other and not a problem in our own society. I mean, one of the things I think we have to ask ourselves is, you know, why should we care about corruption? And it seems to me the reason we should care about corruption is because it's intimately tied up with processes that produce inequality, and it's intimately tied up with processes that create, you know, unjust distribution of resources in the world. And, you know, it seems to me that one of the things that happen as societies become more modern is that we go from situations where the mechanisms that produce inequality are sort of open for people to see, and they're interpersonal, and they're available for people to understand and to criticize, to a situation where those mechanisms that reproduce inequality are sanitized and legitimized. And so, you know, what is in fact the difference between a system in which the elites in Nigeria can accumulate millions of dollars and make them disproportionately rich and comfortable compared to their fellow countrymen, and a system in our country where people do that and it's considered just, you know, being successful? So, I mean, I think those are real and important issues. I will say, though, that in the end, I decided that just because we have a terrible corruption in our society as well, and just because one would run the risk of blaming the victim by writing about corruption in a place like Nigeria, it was not enough of a reason not to take on the topic, because I was struck over and over again, you know, over the last 20 years by how important Nigerians themselves think that the problem of corruption is in their society. And so I wanted in the book to try to take that on and understand it from their point of view.
Thank you. And thanks for calling in to our caller. You speak about corruption. I think one of the really important points that this book makes, and certainly a point that I got from reading it, was that corruption is linked to inequality in society. And Nigeria is a place where inequality is so glaring. There are haves, there are have-nots. There's a huge disparity between the two. It occurs to me that inequality has also increased in our society in recent decades. And do you think this will be linked to, is linked now to more corruption in our society, or will be linked to more corruption in the future as the have-nots, you know, look over there, see what the haves have, feel like maybe they haven't played the game fairly to get it, and feel like, huh, that entitles me to, you know, get a little bit for myself. My family is struggling.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I mean, the mechanisms for ordinary people to be corrupt in our society are very different from the ones that exist in Nigeria. And it seems to me that in American society, most of the most accessible mechanisms to be corrupt are much more available to elites than they are to ordinary people. I mean, it's part of what characterizes the change from a more face-to-face kind of society and form of social organization that characterizes Nigeria and, you know, other places in Africa and the developing world, and the United States and Western society, where you know, the relationships that we have to people who have power are much more anonymous. I mean, mm-hmm. There are those of us, I suppose, in a community or in a city or in a state who know those who have power, and there are people who try to take advantage of that. But I would say for the vast majority of Americans, they don't have a sense of how they would actually manipulate their personal relationships with people in power in order to help benefit themselves. And that's precisely what goes on in Nigeria. As you have this transition from a more face-to-face kind of society where human social relationships still rely on so much on who you know. And so, you know, it's part of the sort of messy process of transformation in a place like Nigeria, that you're moving from the situation where people are getting access to social resources primarily through social networks and social connections, toward a system where the state is supposed to be a more reliable and just arbiter in terms of allocating fair access to resources. And of course, the thing that one worries about is that as Nigeria makes this and other countries around the world makes this transition that makes the state an even more important arbiter in terms of who gets access to resources, the thing that one worries about is whether the state is going to end up being a fair arbiter. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, Nigerians are anxious to have their state be a more transparent and accountable set of institutions. But in the meantime, they don't believe it is so. And so even though they would like to not have to practice the forms of nepotism and string pulling and so on that characterize everyday life there, I think right now they feel like if they left everything up to the state, it would be hijacked by the people who control the state.
Yeah. Well, if you've just tuned in, we're talking this morning on Focus 580. I'm Carol Spindell, and I'm sitting in today for David Inge. We're talking about corruption with anthropologist Dan Smith, and we're talking about his book about his years of fieldwork in Nigeria called A Culture of Corruption, Everyday Deception and Popular Discontent in Nigeria. You know, you write that Nigerians have a strong desire for a more democratic and more transparent society, and you tell some stories that are kind of heartbreaking to read. The young man who has the HIV organization, and he's helping people with HIV and with very little, and then suddenly there's some money available and everyone decides to create an NGO and suddenly get into the HIV business. But I was wondering when I read that story, you know, what happens to someone in Nigeria who decides to swim against the stream and who says, I'm going to play it straight. I'm not going to do this. Are there people like that? And what? How do they manage?
There are countless people like that in Nigeria. I mean, I've always been – Nigeria is a place of vast and untapped potential. I mean, there are so many – Nigerians who have committed their lives and their careers to trying to create a better society. And the story I tell of Benjamin, this guy who runs this NGO in Owerri, trying to help prevent HIV and trying to take care of people who do have AIDS is just one example.
You should just tell that story for our listeners if they haven't heard it.
So, you know, this guy Benjamin had someone in his family who died of HIV, and he was working for a big international development organization in the huge commercial capital of Lagos. And at around 7 or 8 years ago, he decided after one of his relatives died of AIDS, he decided to take the kinds of skills and experience he had learned working for an international organization and go home and start a local NGO. And he's been doing work with the most difficult to reach urban populations, young people who've dropped out of school, young migrants who've come to the city in search of employment in the informal economy. He helped start the first support group for people living with HIV when Nigeria first introduced antiretroviral therapy several years ago. And he's recognized by people who the donor community and by the local Ministry of Health that runs the health programs there as the best expert they have. And several years ago, the World Bank lent Nigeria $90 million for HIV prevention programs, and it was doled out to certain states in Nigeria to help improve their programs. And most of the states created competitions where these local NGOs could compete for money. And Benjamin's was one of the only legitimate NGOs in this region of Nigeria. And so when the competition was announced, he thought he'd have a good shot at getting the money. It turns out that something like 70 NGOs were created, and most of them were fictitious. When the proposals were all reviewed, proposals that had been submitted by politicians and politicians' wives and connected people all got funded, and Benjamin's didn't. In the end, the guy who ran the AIDS program for the government realized that Benjamin's work was so vital that he engineered a way for Benjamin to get a small share of this money, about $30,000. But it was a very telling example of the obstacles that people who want to do well face, and yet there are countless people like Benjamin who continue to try to swim against the current, so to speak. And, there's a lot of support in Nigerian for society for them. Benjamin is a well-respected person, and yet he constantly runs up against, against these obstacles, against people who are benefiting from the status quo and want that to continue. People at higher levels of society who fight against corruption, I think run even greater risks. I mean, there certainly are threats to people who would expose higher government officials and so on. And fighting against corruption at the highest levels of government in Nigeria can be a very dangerous business.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, we know several famous cases of such as Ken Saro-Wiwa, which I believe is in the same area in which you worked.
Yeah, so Ken Saro-Wiwa is south of where I work, but in the same general region. I mean, things, to be fair to Nigeria and to the government of Nigeria, I mean, things have with regard to human rights and the way in which the government deals with dissent and so on, things are certainly far better now post-1999 when there's a transition to civilian rule than they were during the height of the military regimes of the 80s and the 90s. But I think, most Nigerians feel that things could and must get better still.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's always perplexed me about Nigeria is how it is that there can be so much popular discourse and indeed media coverage about issues like corruption, and yet things don't really change, right? I mean, it's almost as if the complaints and the media coverage are sort of like a release valve, but the sort of system still goes on even though everybody's complaining about it. And of course, one of the things that I came to conclusion of is that the same people who are complaining can be in very powerful ways complicit in the perpetuation of the system. And so it's not as if everybody's just complaining and then everybody who's complaining has nothing to do with the perpetuation of corruption. The same people who are complaining in a different moment of their lives can be part of processes that perpetuate corruption. So if you pay a bribe to get your daughter into college, even though you may loathe the idea, in some ways you have become part of the very problem that plagues you.
Absolutely. And you describe it at one point in your book as intractable. And when you see and you understand the complexity of the web and how widespread it is, you really understand how that would be so hard to change. Another important point that you make in the book that I thought was interesting was that as Western donors and development organizations and so on who have a lot of power over these countries through the money that they give and fund and investment, they seem to want to fight corruption by creating a stronger civil society and by giving the money, as you told in the story of the HIV NGOs, toward civil organizations like non-governmental organizations and moving those resources kind of away from government. But as you tell in the story of Benjamin and the NGOs, people who are wealthy, who are well-connected, who know where the money is and know how to follow it, they're just following it wherever it is, and they're just creating NGOs. So it doesn't sound like that's doing a whole lot.
Yeah, I think the move in the 1990s with structural adjustment promoted by the World Bank and neoliberal policies, all of which were designed to kind of increase the importance of the market as a strategy to get our way out of problems in developing countries and decrease the role of the state because states were seen as bloated and corrupt and so on. My sense of that is that those policies haven't worked out very well, and that ultimately donors, Western governments, and so on have to confront the fact that if positive change is going to happen in places like Nigeria, the state has to be a huge partner in that. I'm not saying there's no role for NGOs, no role for civil society. Of course there is, and many people in Nigeria who are frustrated with the state make their greatest contributions by through mechanisms that one might call civil society. But ultimately, it seems to me that if problems of corruption, problems of inequality, problems of development are going to be addressed effectively in places like Nigeria, the state has to be a vital partner in that. And our government and our societies in the West, we have to be more attuned to what role we can play in encouraging states in places like Nigeria to be more responsible, more accountable, more interested in the welfare of their own people. And sometimes that may mean that our own interests have to be given a little bit of a backseat. And that's a very hard thing to do when we depend on a country like Nigeria for, you know, 2 million barrels of oil a day. Sometimes it's hard for us to see that there might be vital human interests in another society that are as important and in greater jeopardy than something that's going on here.
Yeah, and when we look the other way, as you said, with our power and influence and don't say anything, pretend not to see, we're really participating in the same web. And it occurs to me, thinking about that, that it's really a global culture of corruption that you're describing, even though you're just describing the Nigerian corner of it. Do you think corruption is, to some extent, globalized?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think what's important to remember is that the aspects of corruption that are most consequential for poor people around the world are the ones in which we are in some ways, in some cases witting, but in many cases unwitting participants. And I certainly believe that, you know, that ultimately we as Americans, when we, for example, when we receive the 419 email scams, instead of dismissing them and saying, oh, gee, you know, look at those corrupt people over there trying to take advantage of us, I think we need to learn from what's happening and recognize that actually we do have some responsibility for you know, the very circumstances that led these people into the internet cafes desperate enough to try this seemingly preposterous endeavor.
Yeah, and I think with that thought, we're going to unfortunately have to end this conversation. I want to thank our guest today, Professor Dan Smith, an anthropologist from Brown University. He's been joining us by phone from Providence, Rhode Island. If you would like to read more, a very interesting book called A Culture of Corruption, Everyday Deception, and Popular Discontent in Nigeria. It was published by Princeton University Press, and I'm sure you'd be able to find that at your local library, hopefully, or somewhere. Professor Smith, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's been Focus 580 for today. Thanks for listening, and please stay tuned for the afternoon magazine.
Focus 580 is supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Now with 4 area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, now with a new dinner menu. Tapas served every evening until 2 a.m., along with lunch on Friday from 10:30 to 2:30, and brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Information on menus, wine, and beer lists is at RadioMariaRestaurant.com.
It's a minute before 12 o'clock noon. It's time for the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Tom Rogers, and for Celeste Quinn today. And in the noon hour coming up, we'll have our mix of news from the NPR, the BBC, and AM 580, and talk to Mike. You can ask Mike Sola for a weather forecast. In the 1 o'clock hour, we'll have an archived interview with award-winning journalist Mary Beth Keene, the author of The Walking People, a novel. That's coming up at 1:06. Right now on the commodity markets, looks like the beans are slightly up. The corn is down. The wheat is mixed. December wheat in Kansas City is up a penny and a half at 4.75¾. Dease wheat in Chicago up a half cent at 4.62¼, but the March is down a quarter at 4.81¼. December corn is at 3.25 a bushel, down 4 cents. March at 3.38½, down 3¾. May at 3.47½, down 4. Crude oil for October is off 40 cents a barrel at 72.10. The RBOB gasoline at 1.84 even. That's down a penny. Soybeans for November at 9.56¾ a bushel, up 3¾. January 9.60, up 3¾. March at 9.60, up 4½. Bean meal for October, 296.50.